Okay. So today on the Loopcast, I have Mara, and we are going to talk about the Sinai. So the ongoing violence and ongoing disorder, so to speak, to use the lightest word I can think of. In our ongoing series uncovering the Sinai, a couple weeks ago we had Zach Gold, who very much explained the regional and sort of national components of this ongoing problem of violence in Sinai. And today with Mara, we're going to go into sort of the gears and sort of, looking at it from a much more sort of granular level and sort of looking at the individual parts and sort of, the role that Islam and sort of, the tribes in Sinai have to play in sort of the ongoing violence. So I want to start off, Mara. Describe sort of, the historic relationship of the Sinai and its relationship with Cairo in the sense of before the revolution. I mean, in our research before, coming to this interview, we basically, we come to the idea that the Sinai is, it's a collection of tribes, it's a collection of, what, people sort of Islamists. And so we're sort of interested, I mean, what is the sort of history before the revolution of the relationship of the Sinai to Cairo and to sort of the governing order?
Sure. So prior to the, I mean, the first thing to understand about Sinai really is that the primarily Bedouin population has always thought of it very much as sort of semi-autonomous, self-governing, and geographically and even ethnically sort of separate from the rest of what they would call mainland Egypt. So I was actually in Sinai the second week in August, and for example, one of the first things I heard when I was on the ground in Sinai is, "Oh, so you're visiting from Egypt." So there's very much a sense in Sinai that that region is territorial, distinct, and has its own interests, sort of very separate from mainland Egypt, and really interests that diverge from the interests of the central government. And there's a sense that Sinai has historically been treated as almost a colony of mainland Egypt, and sort of exploited as far as its natural resources, natural gas, access to the Suez Canal, proximity to Israel and strategic significance as a buffer zone. So there's this real sense that sort of that the attention, the political representation and attention given to the citizens of Sinai has been very disproportionate to the strategic influence of the region, and this sense among the Bedouin that they've been marginalized from both the political process and macroeconomy. We saw Mubarak actually pumped a lot of resources into developing South Sinai, where he had one of his own sort of vacation resort complexes. So we saw South Sinai become a very lucrative tourist destination. So while sort of the standard of living for the primarily Nile Delta workers who migrated in to staff those resorts started to increase rapidly in the 90s, the overall economic development and quality of living for the Bedouin tribes did not keep pace with that. So we saw this growing disparity really in income levels in Sinai, and I think that's the economic dimension there, sort of the economic marginalization of these groups is a lot of what's been driving the unrest and also their continued antagonism with the central government and resentment of authorities.
Interesting. What would you say is the role of Islam in this? How would you sort of layer on Islam? I mean, are we talking about sort of, is it much more sort of conservative and, sort of Salafi interpretation of the religion, or is it something more in line with the Muslim Brotherhood and very sort of political and very much, Islamist, so to speak?
Sure. So another thing to understand about the history of the Sinai, I mean, jihadist groups, hardline Islamist groups in Sinai have very much been in the news recently. It's important to understand that radical Islam in Sinai really is not an old, there's nothing inevitable about it. It's a very sort of recent introduction, something that that began to develop in the 90s as we started to see, related to the tourism and demographic changes I was talking about earlier, a lot of population migration from the Nile Delta into Sinai. And with that migration came a number of Islamists and Egyptians who had had contact with sort of more conservative Islamist ideology in universities they attended and in our lives, west of the Suez. So as we saw sort of the demographics in Sinai change, an increase in Islamist thought. At the same time, the east, we saw deepening economic and ideological ties with the Gaza Strip. Part of this was through smuggling, but as, the tunnel trade and illegal economy with Gaza sort of deepened, that provided an avenue for Hamas to project ideological influence into Sinai, throughout the 2000s. So we've seen, from a couple of different directions, these Islamizing influences that have had an effect on the ideological orientation of the tribes, which traditionally, they have practiced as far as their customary law and their own Bedouin traditions. These are pre-Islamic in basis. So I've done research and visited some of the customary tribal courts, which administer what's known as Urf, which is pre-Islamic law. Now, increasingly, because of these Islamizing influences in Sinai, we've seen sort of a convergence between the pre-Islamic tribal courts and these newer sort of Sharia courts that are being administered by the newer Salafi group. So there's definitely Salafis and more conservative Islamists are definitely a new and almost alien introduction, or sort of seen as an imported ideology in Sinai, and something that's had a very destabilizing impact on the fabric of tribal society.
Interesting. So, with sort of the revolution in 2011 and sort of the ups and downs of what that entails. So, just looking at the surface, you have Morsi comes to power, he's thrown out of power, and they keep going back and forth. But, what has been the relationship with Cairo and the Sinai post-2011? Did the Muslim Brotherhood sort of try to integrate the Sinai more into, the center's political power, or is it still being marginalized?
Sure. Well, so there was a clear, departure, I think, as far as Morsi's strategy toward the Sinai versus Mubarak's. Mubarak had taken sort of a very heavy-handed interventionist approach to governing Sinai, with alternating security sweeps in which thousands of Bedouin were arrested and tortured in, 2004 through 2006. He also made a point of interfering, sort of manipulating the appointment of tribal leaders known as Mokhtars. So really trying to penetrate the internal tribal governance structures and sort of co-opt them into the state security apparatus. Did that somewhat successfully. Whereas Morsi really tried to, partially due to the incapacity of his own government. We saw in the last months of Morsi's government, his regime really struggling to control the security apparatus. Police departments and outright mutiny is very common in Sinai in the last 6 months of Morsi's presidency to see large-scale protests by police, complaining of, about not having enough resources. And this had to do with the mass redeployment of security personnel sort of toward, Cairo and the urban centers to police unrest there. But so we really saw Morsi having major capacity problems and really kind of even greater retreat of state institutions from Sinai. And that was something that was initially welcomed by a lot of the tribes who had resented, the interference of Mubarak's regime in their day-to-day affairs. However, with the security vacuum that opened up with the fall of Mubarak and under Morsi's rule, we started to see, growing extremism in Sinai, all of these attacks on the pipeline, increased smuggling to Gaza, all of which brought a lot more crime and just instability to the area, and was something that eventually, came to be resented by the tribes again, who were anxious to see the restoration of some sort of stability. So I think there was sort of, on the one hand, there was resentment, there was continued, resentment of the government, but also sort of opportunistic, the tribes trying to make the best use of the security vacuum that opened up there.
Interesting. So what should we expect from somebody like, is it Sisi? My pronunciations right. Are awful. But should we expect a sort of return to the heavy-handedness of the Mubarak era? Or is this sort of, he will try to negotiate sort of, combination heavy hand and, velvet hand or whatever, the counter to right. That is. But what should we expect from him?
Sure, yeah. So whereas actually Morsi had been attempting to do sort of softer negotiations with tribes and been somewhat successful in using mediation and kind of non-military tactics to kind of involve tribal leaders in the release of kidnapped soldiers and kind of work with them on a person-to-person level in that way. We've definitely seen the military sort of revert to the full-blown heavy-handed approach that we saw under Mubarak with airstrikes, massive collateral damage against targeting civilians. I don't have statistics on the number of civilians killed, but there have been scores and scores of houses just leveled in Sinai in the last couple of weeks. So, I think part of the problem here is that the Egyptian military and its equipment and all of the security arrangements in Sinai, based on the treaty with Israel, all of this is oriented around fighting conventional wars. And what we have in Sinai is really a counterinsurgency. And I think what we're seeing now is the Egyptian military sort of like it just very much failing to understand what it takes to root out a counterinsurgency, and instead taking this sort of brute force approach to these militants who are really holed up in very inaccessible parts of Sinai, and instead of taking sort of a surgical approach, and taking them out one by one, they're doing this sweeping and very destructive scorched earth campaign that's contributing to turning the tribes even more so against the state and increasing their sympathies with radicals, I think, as we see the Bedouin population and civilians bearing the brunt of the counterterrorism campaign.
Interesting. So I'm sort of curious then. I mean, how would you describe, the Sinai itself as a political space? So before we get into the issue of the violent actors and sort of their motivations, I'm sort of curious. I mean, it seems like, it almost seems if we were to build a hierarchy, the tribes and then sort of Islam and then sort of the state, and sort of almost the state seems to, it doesn't have a grip, but rather has to impose itself. So, I mean, explain it, the Sinai itself as a, as a political space and sort of the relationship between, the Bedouins, the various, religious actors, and then even the state itself.
Sure. So, as I mentioned before, the religious actors, the Salafi groups in the Sinai, are a relatively new introduction, and they see themselves in a lot of ways, in competition and rivalry with the traditional tribal structures. The both the Brotherhood and the Salafi Nur Party have campaigned heavily there in elections since the revolution and have performed quite well. And that's a function of Islamization in general being on the rise. I believe the Brotherhood, I think in the Morsi's election, I think 80% of the votes in Sinai went for Morsi. So the Brotherhood has definitely had strong support there, and I think we are seeing support for Islamists rising amid this counterterrorism campaign that's having some very radicalizing effects and turning the population against the military. As far as the political space and the Bedouin are concerned, traditionally one of the grievances of the Bedouin has been their underrepresentation in parliament and formal governing institutions in Cairo. While under Mubarak there was a decent amount of sort of penetration of tribal structures and co-optation by the state security apparatus, as I mentioned, manipulation of the appointments of mukhtars, these tribal leaders. So that's given the Bedouins some access to governance. However, their strategy has really always been to secure very instrumental concessions oriented toward their immediate needs in Sinai, whether or not that's development, sort of economic concessions. They feel, I think, very much detached from larger policymaking going on in Cairo and sort of Egypt's macroeconomy, and things like the constitutional process are seen as sort of very, very far removed from the day-to-day concerns of living in Sinai, where they're very real. Real concerns about shortages in food and water. Much more of a sort of the hardships being experienced on a day-to-day basis there. There's a sense of the population, I think, being very far removed from sort of larger policymaking going on in Cairo.
So how would you, I mean, in terms of sort of resolving conflict between the two tribe between tribes, I mean, did the state before sort of the revolution, did the state have a role to play in conflict resolution? Because it almost seems, in your article, Sharia courts of the Sinai. So I'll post this up. It seems like as the state has receded from the Sinai, religious actors have come in, and it almost seems like they're playing the role of mediator and sort of, being able to settle disputes as judges, as Sharia court judges. I mean, is this, how would you describe this sort of, conflict mediation in this space?
Yeah. Well, the way I think about sort of the justice situation in Sinai, it's really a triangular structure where on one end you have the state courts, which are actually now entirely dysfunctional with all the violence that's been going on. They've been forced to shut down and transfer cases elsewhere. So state courts haven't been functioning since at least August. Then the other two legs of the triangle, you have these older traditional the urf courts I mentioned before, customary sort of pre-Islamic courts administering primarily orally transmitted common law. It's been passed down by the Bedouin tribes. So that's the oldest form of informal justice in Sinai. Then you have these newer Sharia courts that started operating underground in the later years of Mubarak's rule. And as soon as Mubarak fell, they were sort of emboldened to take their operations above ground and started building brick and mortar courthouses, and are now very much a part of public life. And, I visited one in the city of Arish, and it was very clearly marked with a sign on a major street. And so, one thing to understand is that the state, at least for the last several decades, has very willingly outsourced the administration of justice and dispute resolution to the informal tribal courts, and then increasingly in the last few years also to Islamic courts. And that has to do with the official justice system being too weak to really handle disputes, and also concerns that as much as the state has tried to interfere in tribal affairs, they recognize that doing that comes with significant backlash. So, where possible, the state has preferred to take sort of a hands-off approach, allow the tribes to play out and adjudicate their own disputes to avoid sort of blowback against the state for meddling in tribal affairs. So, so for the most part, the state in Sinai has been pretty happy to let the tribes administer, resolve their own disputes, as long as in cases of, things like land disputes, even murder cases. Increasingly, the big change that we've seen since the revolution, and at least up until the last couple of weeks when a lot of these hardline Salafi leaders were thrown in jail, was the rise of informal Islamic courts, which are quite separate from the older tribal courts I was discussing before. And these are run by Salafis with sort of ideological, at least, if not more concrete ties to some of the hardline groups that are endorsing extremism in Sinai. So that's definitely been a very troubling development that I've been watching there.
I'm curious about, you mentioned the disputes as property and sort of, and even murder. Is there sort of, what are the bulk of the cases sort of handled by the tribal courts and by the Sharia courts? Is there a sure. division? The tribal courts will handle property and money and family? How does this work? Let me just layer it on. How does one bring a case to these courts? Is it really a matter of standing or, sort of walk us through this?
Right, sure. Well, anyone can bring these two separate systems. There are a couple of important differences between them. One being that the urf courts charge significant fees for their services that can run, into the thousands of dollars per case. So one of the advantages of the Sharia courts is that they operate for free. And for that reason, they're perceived to be a little bit more neutral and less vulnerable to corruption and manipulation than the tribal courts. The Sharia courts are also a little bit less because, as I mentioned, Salafism is sort of a newer introduction to the Sinai. These are less rooted in sort of tribal loyalties. So whereas some of the major urf courts are very tied to specific tribes, a couple of the major tribes in Sinai and are perceived as sort of looking after the interests of those tribes. The Sharia courts are seen as being a little bit more neutral, to the point where Sharia judges, when I was in Sinai, would brag to me that they, frequently heard cases brought by Christians and people, and this being sort of evidence of their perceived neutrality in the community is that, they're equally sort of even-handed, with Christians and, people from various different tribes. So as far as the traditional tribal justice system, the way it's always worked is that over the years, different tribes have developed expertise in different types of customary law. So, so for example, the Bili tribe, there's a tribe that's specialized in murder cases. So if you have a murder case, you would know to go to that tribe. Increasingly, There are other tribes that are specialized in land disputes or divorce proceedings. Some of the most common cases are actually involving property and land disputes. And this is a function of just, the changing developmental and economic situation in Sinai. I mean, traditionally, these were tribal nomadic societies in which there was no sort of private property in a traditional sense. It's only been over the last 100 years or so, with the penetration and consolidation of state institutions in Sinai that we've seen the demarcation of property as kind of an institution. So, and that opens the door for then disputes over property. So that's been one of the fundamental changes driving sort of the informal justice system in Sinai has been this increased emphasis on financial and property-based disputes, which is something that wasn't necessary or part of the system hundreds of years ago.
I'm curious, how does the court, whether tribal or Islamic, sort of enforce its will? Does it have an associated constable, an associated police force? Or is it really sort of a matter of honor and sort of respecting, the court itself?
Right. Yeah, that's a great question because, these courts, whether they're tribal or Islamic, they do not have at their disposal the enforcement, capacity of the state or the support of the police. So they have a couple of ways of dealing with that. For one thing, the tribal justice system, yes, as you mentioned, is extremely honor-based. One thing that they will do as an enforcement mechanism is appoint what's known as a kafil, which is a guarantor, someone with enormous prestige and standing in the community who sort of will vouch for the two litigants in the dispute, and often those two litigants will deposit with the kafil something of great value to them, like an asset. They could give him a car or a camel or something to hold in reserve until the dispute is resolved. And so it's their fear of alienating that person of great standing in the community that sort of keeps this process going and keeps it together, because basically to default on whatever the judgment is, or to would be an insult to the kafil and thus basically equivalent to social death in these communities. So that's part of what holds it all together. And interestingly, that raises the question of how these courts adjudicate disputes involving people outside of the tribes and outside of the community. For example, between someone from the Nile Delta and someone from one of the tribes, there are cases involving people from outside of Sinai that have been successfully litigated, but obviously those people are much less bound by sort of the tribal codes of honor, and it would be from an enforcement perspective, it's much more difficult to impose judgments on them. On the Islamic court side, they've adapted some of those same enforcement mechanisms, including the kafil. There's also this practice called tawthiq, which is where you can sort basically borrow or steal sort of an asset of your adversary in court. This often takes the form of stealing your adversary's car and sort of keeping it onto it for the duration of litigation, and then it's returned at the end of it. So it's sort of like an insurance, a way to kind of force your adversary to appear in court. And the Sharia judges in Sinai told me that this is not considered un-Islamic because it's all the temporary theft is all sort of factored into the judgment, and it's all squared out kind of in the end judgment, and when things are kind of made right. Another thing. There has been talk, among the Sharia judges, and sort of hope that eventually, some of these so-called popular committees, which are so far kind of unarmed community policing units, could be utilized to help enforce the judgments of Sharia courts. Obviously, this is all very much up in the air right now, with a number of Sharia judges being in jail. They've been arrested as part of the military's counterterrorism campaign. But the Sharia courts do have something that's called an enforcement bureau, which is concerned with just this, the enforcement of judgments. And they insisted to me that they don't use violence to enforce any judgments. It's more sort of the threat or the capability of force, I think, that is... that is at issue here. So I think there's at least, if not the use of force to implement judgments, I think the Sharia courts definitely leverage at least the threat of it.
Interesting. So I'm sort of curious, how do you determine standing with the court? It almost seems like, in my mind, I pictured, maybe it's a little, in my mind, I pictured it much more comedic, but, somebody going from judge to judge and sort of asking, for a better judgment, or, sort of saying that Judge A, their judgment wasn't as favorable, and then going to Judge B, Judge C, and sort of going between tribal courts and Islamic courts. I mean, does that happen, or is it, you know, you present your case to one judge, and then that determination and that judgment is, you know, cannot be replaced by any other court or any other sort of judge?
Sure. Yeah, that's interesting. You know, because these systems are separate and have, you know, distinct jurisdictions, it is possible to sort of relitigate or basically, you know, if you're not satisfied with an outcome in one system, people do, in fact, often take their disputes to another system. So it's very common, actually, in state courts when people are dissatisfied with the judgment, when they're dissatisfied with the judgment of a state court, would try to relitigate that dispute. Either you have to first persuade your adversary to go back to court again, but they could go either to an Urf court or to a Sharia court. The Sharia courts, their appeals process is more difficult, and it's sort of more of a one-shot deal. The appeals process sort of requires restarting the case from scratch. Appeals are easier under the Urf system. So actually, Sharia courts, a number of Sharia judges told me that they had heard cases of people who had come from Urf courts and were unhappy with their decisions there. So it really is very it's a very kind of opportunistic system in which individuals sort of very much choose their forum or choose the court based on what they think will yield the best outcome for their case.
Interesting. So I want to sort of switch topics just a little to the issue of violence. I mean, I think anybody who's been watching Egypt, you know, for the last, you know, the duration of the summer, so to speak, has, you know, we've witnessed sort of an uptick in violence in the Sinai. And so, you know, you've been to the Sinai, you've done a lot of research on the Sinai. Sort of, how would you describe the violence that's taking place? You know, it almost seems, you know, you've described the Sharia courts as, and, you know, the Bedouins as sort of creating a parallel authority to the state, to the state's authority. But at the same time, you know, in news reports, it almost seems like there's a lot of what would be considered insurgent and even, you know, sort of terrorist violence, sort of the, you know, intentional targeting of elements of the state in order to sort of, you know, produce fear or produce, you know, whatever the outcome is. So, I mean, you know, describe sort of the violence that's taking place, you know, for us.
Sure. Yeah. So there's really a very strong narrative, you know, in this, this violence intensified dramatically after July 3rd, and hardline Islamists and extremists in Sinai explicitly justify these retaliatory attacks on government targets as, you know, revenge for, you know, what happened to Morsi and the exclusion of the Brotherhood from political life in Cairo. So I see it very much connected to two events in Cairo and sort of a direct response to, you know, when you have a violent breakup of a pro-Morsi sit-in in Cairo, inevitably, you know, that day or the next day, there are violent retaliatory attacks against security targets in Sinai. So the two are very much linked. And increasingly, we've also seen growing capability among Sinai-based extremists to coordinate attacks on targets in Cairo, so that the geographical sort of range of their capabilities is definitely increasing, as well as the sophistication of the technologies at their disposal. And part of that is due to, you know, every time they raid a police station, or they're stealing police cars, they're obtaining more sophisticated weaponry from these security targets they're raiding. So you know, in the last, since September 8th, I guess when the military sort of air campaign really intensified in Sinai, we've seen sort of a temporary suppression of militant activity. But I think I think that is very much temporary. And, you know, what we know about hardline Islamists is that they're very adept at operating underground and, you know, regenerating themselves under conditions of repression. So, you know, these are not organizations that can be neutralized by decapitating their leadership, by taking out sort of a few of the a few jihadists. You know, the way these organizations are really fueled by these, you know, narratives of martyrdom and revenge. So sort of the, you know, unfortunately, the more of these jihadists you eliminate, the more, you know, the more their peers are going to be inspired to retaliate. So I think, unfortunately, the military's campaign has proven to be quite short-sighted, and I think is, over the long run, going to exacerbate instability and problems with civilization in Sinai.
You use the phrase jihadists. I mean, is this, you know, is this an ideology similar to Al-Qaeda, or are we talking about sort of, Salafi, Bedouins with maybe a conservative ideology or a Salafi ideology sort of rebelling against the state? Or is this really, the ideology of Al-Qaeda and sort of that very extreme, sort of ideology sort of seeping into the Sinai?
Right. I mean, I use the term jihadist very deliberately, and that specifically denotes a group of extremists who view violence as the only legitimate means of effecting political change. So, whereas a number of Salafi groups in Egypt have opted to participate in the political process peacefully, and have engaged with institutions, they participated in the constitutional process. Jihadists have really thoroughly renounced political institutions as bankrupt of legitimacy, and they are engaging in street level violence, mobilization and armed attacks, basically armed insurgency against the state. They view that as really as a legitimate political strategy.
Interesting. So I'm sort of curious. I mean, what has been the Egyptian state's response? I mean, are they using sort of combination police and military, or is, not even the police are not even the issue. It's a full sort of military engagement in into the Sinai.
Yes, no, that's correct. They're using sort of very conventional, as I mentioned before, military tactics that are much more better suited to conventional warfare than the type of sort of low-level counterinsurgency we're seeing. And for that reason, even though the military is claiming success in these operations, and every week we see new figures published about the number of jihadists killed, which can in any way be verified because the military sort of has a chokehold on any of the media coverage and information coming out of the Sinai. So there's no sort of way to cross-check or verify that information. But yes, we're seeing the military take sort of a zero tolerance approach to extremism in Sinai, and they're also blaming the Brotherhood by proxy for groups that they see as sharing interests with the Brotherhood at this point. So even though, I mean, the Brotherhood leadership in Cairo is very much on the run and hasn't been heard from in weeks, and they're not using their cell phones, the military has been doing their best to sort of conflate the terrorism problems we're seeing in Sinai with the Brotherhood, and therefore sort of justify further sanctions and retaliatory measures against Brotherhood leaders in the organization, including trials going on against Brotherhood figures, and the freeze of the organization's assets.
Interesting. So I want to sort of read a passage, and maybe we can sort of, to sort of get to a certain point. So this is from an article that was published 3 days ago, and it's called "In Egypt, Sinai Military's Harsh Campaign Earns Pledges of Retaliation." So the article opens up describing, this operation in the Sinai. So there's a helicopter overhead, and here's the key point, I think, of the article. Each company of ground troops seems to have its own form of attack. In one village, home after home is riddled with tank rounds. In another, the military flattens the homes. In a third, military simply ransacks the houses it enters. So I'm sort of curious. I mean, it really does seem, this attempt by the Egyptian government to sort of, I understand this is sort of anecdotal evidence, but I mean, it seems like their attempt to sort of reassert authority over the Sinai is very much, sort of a reversion back to the Mubarak period and sort of the heavy hand. I mean, with that being said, I mean, do you think the Egyptian military, can rebuild institutions? I mean, it seems like, if we couple this with sort of our previous conversation, with the idea that, the ability to reassert political order and reassert political authority is a problem everywhere. It almost seems, in the Sinai, it's being exacerbated by violence and by the fact that the military is a conventional military, not necessarily a counterinsurgent force.
Right. No, I mean, I actually, unfortunately, I think, you know, from the standpoint of democratization, what's going on now in Egypt is sort of the opposite of institution building. This is sort of a show of brute force by the state that's attempting to sort of that's attempting to consolidate power by basically terrifying the opposition out of participating. And I think actually an interesting thing about that passage you noted is that something about the different divisions each taking a different approach. In the different villages. And I think that actually speaks to something, I've observed in Sinai for a long time, which is the total lack of interagency coordination and lack of professionalism among the various sort of interwoven elements of the security apparatus, be it the police, secret police and the army. None of them are coordinating particularly well. And this is a very much sort of an ad hoc reactionary campaign that's not really suited or responding to actual, events on the ground, and it was proving to be very out of touch with the dynamics in Sinai, and failing to really account for the ways in which the military is actually inflaming the problem of radicalization, and actually forfeiting what could be a very valuable opportunity to engage with the tribes on intelligence. I mean, the tribes are the only ones who have a sense of what's going on in Sinai, and they know where the jihadist groups are and how they operate. And I think actually, one positive thing Morsi did do was try to engage, on a security dimension with some of these tribes. And I think the military is sort of foregoing a very valuable opportunity to do that right now by alienating these tribes and pushing them closer to hardline Islamists. And as far as, institution building, I even though we see the procedural, beginnings of new institutions in Egypt right now, as far as the framework for a constitutional process and the timeline for parliamentary and presidential elections, these are processes that are only including half of the country. I mean, we're seeing the Brotherhood organization banned, its leaders in jail. So I think there's a real danger that the military is perpetuating some of the same sort of exclusionary policies that Morsi was criticized for, and which ultimately brought an end to his presidency. So I think, we're seeing some of the some superficial gestures toward institution building, but not to the extent that we're going to see public confidence in institutions restored. And I see particularly the judiciary and the politicization of courts and the use of the justice system by the military to consolidate its own power as being a major problem and something driving radicalization. For example, when I was in Sinai, Islamists told me, that they consider, that the problem of military trials and the arbitrary detention of Islamists as evidence of sort of the total failure and illegitimacy of the official justice system, and that's why they need things like Sharia courts, and that's why jihadists feel compelled to pursue political change through violence outside of the political process. So, I think really, that Egypt's biggest challenge is going to be build confidence in truly neutral institutions that are held accountable and that aren't used by aren't used by leaders to consolidate their own power.
Interesting. So I'm sort of curious. I mean, what is the military's involvement in Sinai due to the reputation of the military? Because, I mean, it seems like in our previous conversation and sort of through our research, I mean, it seems like the military is the only institution in Egypt with a positive reputation, in the sense of, if you compare the military with the police, with the Mukhabarat, with the Secret Service or the spy agency or whatever you want to call it, it almost seems like the military has a positive reputation. But now, as it, do you think its reputation will suffer as it sort of involves itself in what looks like to be a protracted war in the Sinai?
Sure. Yeah. I mean, I think the military has had high approval ratings. This past year, as Morsi's popularity deteriorated, and I think you're right. Actually, the military really leveraged and kind of exploited the police to do a lot of the dirty work of breaking up the sit-ins in Cairo in order to sort of preserve its own kind of more sense of moral high ground, and really, the police and CSF have been the ones doing the dirty work of breaking up the Islamist protests. So the military, in that sense, has preserved has been able to preserve some of its reputation. I do think that, you know, within the Sinai, there the military, it's become an increasingly, toxic environment for any state security personnel. You know, I was told, when I went there, to stay very far away from any checkpoints or, police security personnel, because, you know, those are the guaranteed targets, for these kinds of attacks. And I think increasingly, you know, as we see a growing number of sort of terrorist attacks in spreading to Cairo and other parts of Egypt, tied to sort of the unrest that we're seeing in Sinai, there's going to be more questioning of the military's counterterrorism campaign and how effective it really is. So, you know, and I think particularly as we see the military turn on journalists and these nodes of criticism, you know, this crackdown is no longer limited exclusively to Islamists. You know, we've seen the arrest of non-Islamist journalists. And I think we're going to see that those efforts to manage the public's perception of the conflict, the standoff continues. So as the military starts to turn its attention to non-Islamist sources of opposition, I think its reputation is going to definitely take a hit.
Interesting. I mean, I think it almost seems like, you know, there's an effort by the military to sort of control what the media sees in the Sinai. So from the same article I quoted previously, it says, you know, what random, said Major General Sa'am Bashadi, excuse me, the director of the North Sinai Security, clearly offended at the suggestion that the campaign was sweeping indiscriminately through villages. We only assault very specific targets, and that is why it's very difficult, because everything is very close to one another. We only assault specific targets without harming any innocent. And it's based on very accurate information. So, I mean, it almost seems like what you've said before, I mean, is in sharp contrast to this statement. I mean, is this, you know, is this an attempt by the Egyptian military to sort of, you know, put lipstick on a pig, so to speak, or, you know, to...
Right, yeah. I mean, that's very true. The military has been very, very sensitive to allegations of collateral damage to civilian targets in Sinai, and we've seen this. There's a very high-profile trial going on right now of a journalist who was reporting in Sinai on reports of the destruction of civilian property, several weeks ago. So really, you know, we've heard on a number of reports of journalists in Sinai being arrested, physically assaulted by security personnel, in attempts to sort of intimidate and silence them. So really, I mean, as a sort of a political field and space, the Sinai has sort of this powerful kind of almost mythological quality, for the military, and is being used as kind of the entire justification for its campaign against Islamists. So it's been very important strategically for the military to control the representation of this conflict and for it to look like a success.
Interesting. I mean, you know, is this going to be a long campaign then? Because it almost seems like what you very, very, you know, very well have described to us almost sounds like, you know, an insurgency. It almost sounds like, you know, like a situation similar to the United States in Afghanistan, the United States in Iraq, or, you know, any other sort of insurgency. So my question is, you know, should we expect the Egyptian military to be involved in the Sinai for 5, 6, you know, up to a decade, 5, 6, 7 years, you know, up to a decade? Or is this something that the Egyptian military just wants to wash its hands clean of and just, you know, go in, you know, beat some heads in, blow up some houses, and then just leave?
Right. I mean, as I suggested before, I think that latter approach isn't going to work. I mean, even if the military wanted to make this a very sort of short, surgical and limited engagement, they don't have the capacity to really eradicate extremist groups in Sinai, because these are self-perpetuating groups. But also, you know, there's a transnational dimension to the jihadist environment in Sinai now, where we know a significant number of these fighters are foreigners. So that we know the conflict is pulling in people from other places, and will continue to do so as long as as long as, you know, Islamists in Sinai are under siege, and they're able to sort of leverage this, you know, propaganda of martyrdom to recruit new followers. And I think it's also, you know, I wouldn't want to put a timeline on it as far as, you know, how long the insurgency is going to continue, but I do see it being very much linked to events in Cairo. And as long as we see, you know, I suspect the trial of Mohamed Morsi begins on November 4th, and that's going to be a very powerful mobilizing tool for more hardline Islamists, and something that they're going to be able to leverage to sort of to rally supporters. So I think as long as we see you know, this campaign of retaliation against Islamists and their exclusion from the political process, we're going to see them resorting to violence. So, you know, I do expect as long as unrest continues in Cairo, the military is going to be spread pretty thin. You know, as far as if they have to police urban centers, they can't be fully deployed in Sinai. So I do think this has the potential to be to devolve into a very long-term insurgency, and something that, you know, unfortunately pulls in a lot of radical international actors as well.
Interesting. So I think we've covered a lot today. Thank you so much for coming on. But we always like to sort of, you know, let the guest have the last word, the last comment, or, you know, something to leave the audience with thinking about.
Sure. You know what? I think, you know, in Sinai, the military's campaign, you know, it's really handicapped by you know, focusing on treating you know, the symptoms of a problem rather than its root causes. So, you know, rather than focusing on eradicating jihadists, I think that, you know, a better longer term strategy would be to focus on addressing sort of these core economic and political grievances of the Bedouin community there, and try to, you know, bring them more into the fold of the state, you know, rather than continue, you know, alienating the population in ways that are going to make them align with and be more sympathetic to radical groups. So, you know, I would just say that, I mean, I think the solution to Sinai is a comprehensive, you know, development one with a strong, with a heavy economic dimension, and can't just be, you know, security heavy strategy.
Well, thank you so much for coming on.
Great. Thanks so much.
Sure.
Okay. Take care.